Just to draw on this week's parsha, I'll share a vart that I had mentioned in Chumash class, shir, which has direct relevance on this whole concept of being ready and getting ready to the extent possible before getting married, whereby the introduction to the shidduch of Yitzchak and Rivka is Vashem Beiraches Avraham Bakol, that Hashem blessed Avraham with everything. And the word Bakol, Rashi says, is Gematria Bein, Gematria son, because he had a son, he had to marry him off. And the question is, if the Torah means a son, why doesn't the Torah say Ben? Why doesn't the Torah say Bakol with everything that then has to be reinterpreted through Gematria and Remez to a son? And the following pshat may be the root of it all. That although that Yitzchak, Avraham Avinu, knew that he had a son Yitzchak who had great potential, but who said that Yitzchak would realize his potential? It was only after the Akedah, when Yitzchak was ready and willing, Bakol, to give his all and commit and dedicate it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he said, now my son has reached his potential, now he is a Bakol Nick, and now he's ready, he's done his work, to be ready and prepared, he's okay, and he's ready and prepared for marriage. So that's the basic concept that we've been working with, not necessarily to realize one's fullest potential, but at least to become as shalom as one can beforehand, so as not to bring and drag problems into a more complex situation. The last topic we spoke of was stability in Yiddishkeit. And related to that is the next topic, which is a minimum amount of basic Torah knowledge. How much does one have to learn or to know how to learn? What do you have to know in order to get married? And obviously, it's very difficult to quantify that. As a general rule, we can say that the more Torah one learns, the more knowledgeable you are, hopefully the better person you are, the more developed a person you are, and in many ways that can affect the kind of girl you marry, the kind of shidduch that one can get. There are many girls, particularly balas teshuvah, but certainly not limited to that, who want to know what level of knowledge, what yediyas haTorah, what capacity does he have, because that's a reflection on where he's at and what he's accomplished. So again, it's difficult to quantify that, because obviously the more the better. But what are certain practical things that are helpful? Well, number one, practical skills. There are people who may know how to learn a Tosfos quite well, but will make 17 and a half Hebrew pronunciation mistakes when making Kiddush and the like. So some of the practical day-to-day skills that are necessary in running a home and functioning well. Having a good basic knowledge of halacha. Having a good, well-rounded, at least basic knowledge of halacha. And maybe as important, the ability to know how to look up a halacha. And the next step beyond that is the relationship with a Rebbe to know how to ask a shayla. Asking a shayla requires knowledge as well. You don't ask anything and everything. You need to know what to ask and what not to ask. So, number one, having a general framework of basic halacha. Number two, being able to look up, have the skills, tools to look up a halacha. And when that doesn't work, or at least you see what it says, but you still don't know the application to yourself, to be able to ask a shayla from a Rav, which ties into another issue, which is having a relationship with a Rebbe, a mentor. Because whom you have a relationship with, in many cases, helps define who you are. The Aseh Lecha Rav concept, and whom you pick as a mentor, says a lot about whom you are. And therefore, before getting married, it's a good idea to be able to establish some kind of a tie and a relationship with a Rebbe mentor. Another thing that's also a very important practical skill is knowing enough to be able to learn with your children. Whether it's Chumash, whether it's Mishnayos, and whether it's ultimately Gemara. Are these absolute prerequisites? Can a person not get married if he doesn't, if he won't be able to keep up with his kid when his kid is in seventh grade? No. But the basic fundamental skills we're talking about that are very practically helpful are illustrated by the kiddush making, by the knowing general halacha, being able to ultimately determine the halacha, being able to have a rebbe who's going to guide the family as well, and to be able to the best of your ability, learn with your children and Yirtzeh Hashem. And that's all I'll talk about in terms of basic Torah knowledge, because otherwise it's too difficult, as I said, to be specific. Another important area, I'll call it communication skills. It's very good to develop, one hasn't already, and to examine what my ability is in problem-solving skills. How good am I when I hit a problem? A classical problem in that area is the individual who, when hitting a problem, closes the door, says, I hit the brick wall, turns around, and runs away to a new situation. Instead of grappling with, dealing with, and hopefully solving the problem, there are many individuals who, when they hit a problem, not having the tools to deal with it, just say, okay, I'll move on. And if you translate that into a marriage, that means if I hit a problem, or rather when we hit a snag in our relationship, I'm just going to move on, basically chuck the marriage and leave and try to find another wife. But that process will continue until one learns how to confront, deal with, and problem solve. Related to under the heading of communication skills is also listening skills. Crucially important to be able to listen. And they tell the story of the two chavrusas who were learning for an entire zman until they realized that one was learning Masechta Bechiras and the other was Brachas. But they were talking but not listening. Related to this is the ability, which really ties into problem solving, the ability to be flexible and the ability to compromise. Sometimes there are individuals who are so rigid and so set in their ways that they're referred to as kablu daiti niks. You must accept my opinion. Okay, kablu daiti niks. There are people who are sometimes naturally or develop into being confrontational people. In fact, there's a term for those people. They're called ipcha mistavra niks. That means whatever you say, they'll try to give you the flip side because they're argumentative. Contentious, and whatever you say, they'll try to outdo you. In most cases, both of the two above characteristics are rooted in insecurity. If I'm insecure, then I can't really listen to somebody else, but I have to control the other person by letting the other person listen, insist that he or she listens to me. The person who has to have his way, who is very rigid, is usually the person who is inflexible, again, is rather insecure, and therefore can't have the flexibility and latitude of hearing what somebody else has to say, and maybe the other person is right. But Chas v'Shalom, I'm so afraid that I might be wrong, that I'm defensive about it, and therefore highly opinionated. So flexibility and compromise are midos that really need to be worked on if an individual assesses himself as being lacking in that area. Another, under communication skills, is the ability to express emotions appropriately. There are many people who have a hard time being emotionally expressive in an appropriate way, whether it's anger, whether it's appreciation, whether it's love. If you have a feeling, can you share that feeling with someone? If you're upset with someone, can you share that feeling with somebody in an appropriate way? Rather than bottle it up and then only express anger when it's built up so much that the lid gets blown off, because I couldn't express that. I couldn't give somebody mussar in a calm way. That's so I didn't give mussar. So then the person bothered me more because he's totally unaware of the fact that he's bothering me. And then I get hotter and hotter under the collar. By the time he does it, the 106th time, that's when I finally blow my lid, and the poor unsuspecting individual has no idea that he was bothering me all this time, and I never let him know because I didn't know how to appropriately express the emotion of being upset, which would have solved the whole problem had we dealt with it day one. Caring affection is crucial in a marriage. The woman who is emotionally starved and whose husband won't be able to say "I love you" to her is not going to be much of a husband, and it's going to create huge problems in marriage. So we need to be able to learn how to be complimentary, how to be able to express care, liking someone, and so on in an appropriate way. So this is what I would call communication, healthy and well-developed communication skills. related to that, we'll talk about the one emotion which, according to all opinions, is the most destructive one to marriage. And what is that? Anger. By far, and universally accepted, the most destructive element in a marriage is anger. And frequently, there are people who have unresolved anger. What happens now is only opening up the hatch, and all of a sudden you just touch that person and the individual blows up. In many cases, it's not simply a short fuse on the part of an individual, he just has a temper. In many circumstances, what's really going on is the person is fundamentally angry about something in his life. It could even be something where nobody did anything objectively wrong to him. It could simply be that, lo aleinu, his mother passed away when he was young, and somehow or another he felt abandoned, and as a result he was angry, and whomever he was angry at. And lying beneath the surface is always this unresolved anger. Now somebody bumps into him. Or slaps him on the back a little bit too hard. And he blows up way out of proportion. What's really going on? He's really... I'll give you the best muscle that comes to mind. I had two little sons that were barely a year apart. The younger of the two sons... And they were little kids. The younger of the two sons was the typical middle child. The older one was always the first. The older one always got priority. The older one could do things, and this second kid was always second fiddle. And in fact, at one point or another, although we believe in keeping kids home as long as possible, but just to get the two kids, separate the two kids, we sent the older kid when he was very young to... a Yiddish-speaking spiel class, a play group. And he learned the Parshas HaShavua. So he'd come home, and I remember it was Parshas Balak. So he learned about Bilam riding on the donkey. So he comes home, and he sits on his younger brother, and he slaps him, and he says, "Aizel, go, go!" You know, okay. That was what was going on. So what happens? My wife gives out a piece of chocolate, and... she breaks it off approximately into two halves, gives the older one piece, and the younger one another piece. So what do the kids do? What do kids do when they each get a piece? They measured whose piece of chocolate is bigger. And the second son's piece of chocolate was a millimeter, shorter or smaller than the other one. He threw himself down on the floor and went into a tantrum because he got a slightly smaller piece of chocolate. And my wife said to him, "That's not nice. Just because you get a smaller piece of chocolate, you have to make such a fuss." So I called my wife out and I said, "Let me tell you what I think is going on. That boy is really saying the following. I am a deprived child. I am second fiddle. I get nothing firsthand. No new clothes, no. I am essentially a deprived kid. When you give out chocolate, he's saying subconsciously, when you give out chocolate, you should really give me, to compensate for all that deprivation, you should be giving me 3 pieces and him 1 piece. And if you did that for the next 10 years, maybe you would make up for everything that happened. What you just did now is you added insult to injury. When you gave my older brother a piece of chocolate that's a drop bigger, you just brought home the whole sorrow of my whole life. You just reminded me of everything. And it's not the chocolate that he's upset about. You just reminded him and reconfirmed that he's no good and he's not a deserver, or maybe he feels he deserves and he's deprived. You just did it all over again. That's really what's going on. Now, so addressing the chocolate is not going to solve the problem. You have to address the bigger issue of the underlying feeling of being upset of whatever that is. So one of the most important issues regarding anger is to find out, what am I really upset about? And to address that. And then there are people who may not have underlying anger that just gets ticked off at the slightest little nick, but they talk maybe quick to anger. And there are tools and techniques and methods that people need to learn. As I mentioned to somebody recently, there's a beautiful sefer that has, in Hebrew, of course, Erech HaPayim, that has a collection for many, many, many different svarim about tools and techniques to address anger. And in fact, Rabbi Pliskin recently wrote a book that's called Anger. It's supposed to be a wonderful book. Although I was told that the Chafetz Chaim always had that sefer Erech HaPayim on his desk. Always had it in front of him, more than just a reminder that one needs to be Erech HaPayim, slow to anger. So that's an issue that certainly needs to be addressed. Now let's get to the issue of Parnassa, career, preparedness for Parnassa. First of all, I'll share with you an interesting incident that happened a number of years ago. I was in Eretz Yisrael. And I met an avreich, a younger man, who was learning in Kol in Bnei Brak. And I said to him, can you please tell me, the story goes, this is about 27 years ago. And I said, can you please tell me how the economics works? How does the system work in Bnei Brak? You have thousands and thousands of younger light sitting and learning in Kol, and they have very little income. Explain to me how it works. And he said, it's very simple. He said, it's the Mishnah Perkei Avos, al shloish dvarim ha'olam aymed. There are three things that the world stands on. Ala Torah, Bal Ha'avoda, Bal Gimilas Chasadim. Ala Torah, that's your kollel check. Al Ha'avoda, the work, that's your wife's paycheck for her job. But at the end of the month, you don't have enough money to pay your bills. So Gimilas Chasadim, you go to a gemach and you borrow the rest. That's how it works in Bnei Brak. So I said to him, but if you keep on borrowing and it keeps on adding accruing, so how do you ever end up? He said, that's where the nace comes in. Okay. Now, years ago, Or Sameach had a branch in Zichron Yaakov, and the apartments were very inexpensive. And since then, it's become an independent yeshiva, Or Yaakov. Very frequently, Neve Yerushalayim girls would end up marrying Or Sameach Bachrim, and they would then go off and learn in Zichron Yaakov. And this was being pushed. And they had a great meeting, large meeting in Neve Yerushalayim. Because apparently what was happening is that the finances weren't there, despite the fact that the apartment may have cost you only $25 a month. But nevertheless, there are other things that you need to live on. And the income was very paltry. These were exclusively Balei Teshuva. They didn't have additional assistance from his parents, from her parents, and so on. And they would start going into debt. And they called it at the Neve Yerushalayim meeting Zichron Yaakov, and they lived happily ever after, which means all the girls would come to the wedding, they would dance with a halo and rosy pictured imagination of what's going to happen. This young couple, you know, the guy just recently went to yeshiva a year or two ago. She just recently went a year or two ago to Neve Yerushalayim, and they're zeichah to become kollel couples, and they're learning in Zichron Yaakov, and they lived happily ever after. But the reality is that 2 to 3 years later, they came back to America in great debt, and with a lot of stress, and then had to scramble for parnasa. So once the pattern became readily knowledgeable, people became aware that that if you looked a little bit beyond your noses, these people were getting into trouble. So they had a great meeting at Neve Yerushalayim to try to tell the teachers not to recommend that these girls look for husbands or push their husbands to go and study in kollel, because it often doesn't work. Now, Rav Shach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, mentioned to Rabbi Tauber several times, and he mentioned the following thing. He said, "I'm upset with Rosh Yeshiva who recommend that Balei Teshuva sit and learn in kollel." Again, we're brushing with broad strokes, we're talking about generalities. And he says, because the problems and the stresses that come about as a result of it come to my doorstep. Rabbi Rakowski had somewhat of an unfortunate but extraordinary experience years ago when he was living in Yerushalayim. And there was a young man, a very bright man, a Baal Teshuva, who was married, and his marriage wasn't going well. He was learning in kollel in Yerushalayim, and his marriage wasn't going well. There were a lot of strife. And he came to Rabbi Rakowski and asked for an etzah, and he said, "Look, I went to my Rosh HaKollel," and he said, "What you should do is focus and concentrate on learning your sugya of Gemara, and hopefully everything will go well." He said, "But I tried that already, and it hasn't worked. So what should I do?" So Rabbi Rakowski said, "There's a very, very wise man here in Yerushalayim, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. His name is Rav Yitzchak Huttner. He's a very, very, very insightful person. I recommend you go to him and discuss the matter with him." And Rabbi Rakowski wasn't there. However, this young man did go to Rav Huttner and came back and reported to Rabbi Rakowski what Rav Huttner had said. And he said that Rav Huttner said to him the following: "My advice to you is you should close your Gemara for full-time learning, move with your wife back to America, get yourself a decent job so that you'll be able to support your family, get up early in the morning with Mesiras Nefesh and learn, have a Seder early in the morning, have another Seder to some extent at night, and then you'll be doing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of you. And those who are advising you to sit and learn, which is adding to this stress," I don't even want to quote what he said, but he said something very terrible about those people who were advising him to sit and learn. I don't want anyone to misconstrue what I'm saying. I'm not saying that nobody who is a Baal Teshuva should ever think of learning in kollel. However, for the overwhelming majority of people who attempt to do it, one doesn't have the infrastructure, the emotional support, or usually the financial support that it takes to be able to do that successfully. Usually, actually, there are 5 sources of support that the average kollel yungaman has. He has his parents, he has her parents, assuming they're FFBs. He has the kollel check, and he has his wife's paycheck, and he may have government subsidies of one kind or another. And if you just think about it, in most cases, in the world of Balei Teshuva, one doesn't have the subsidies from both parents. One may not have learned in a yeshiva long enough and be an upstanding member or enough of a Talmud Chacham to be able to earn a kollel check. So most of the they might not be comfortable accepting government subsidies. So that's not how they grew up or they're accustomed to. And then all of the strain and stress is put on this poor wife, who, especially for the Eretz Yisrael, she's not even legally allowed to work if she's an American, and the pay is extremely low. The bottom line is that from a financial point alone, there are enormous stresses that often just simply don't make it work well. Now, We had a bachur learned here in the yeshiva years ago, and he was a very nice, fine, intelligent, and sweet guy, big bal chesed, and he had an undergraduate degree and some very helpful majors such as geography. And I remember that he got married, and he said, "You know what? I'll figure it out after I get married." He got married, got a job in a business in New Jersey. And that job in customer relations, it didn't work out. His wife was going to school part-time. She then had a baby. And all of a sudden, he's jobless. And again, he was a perfectly nice, fine guy. The economy wasn't terrible either. And all of a sudden, his marriage almost fell apart because his wife felt that he's not responsible. Here he is. He got married to me. He's got to shoulder the burden of paying the bills, and he can't make a parnassa. And things went from bad to worse. So finally, he enrolled in a COPE computer programming crash course, which would take him 6 months. And because he's busy with that and he needed the parnassa, he moonlit by driving a local car service. So he slept about 4 hours a night for 6 months. As soon as he finished, the community got together to try to help find him a job, and he got a job right away, and that saved his marriage. And Baruch Hashem, he's doing beautifully today. Today he owns a home in an out-of-town community. He's even a Rebbe at night for introductory Gemara. Has a beautiful family, and so on. And he told me once, he said, Rabbi Braun, if any bacher, any starry-eyed bacher comes to you and says, you know what, I'll date first, I'll get married first, I have a degree, you know, I'll figure it out later. He said, do that bacher an enormous favor. Give him my telephone number. Okay? Now, what does that mean in terms of practical realities? Well, let's start moving halfway. I have heard hundreds of times, literally hundreds of times, a bacher come to me and say, you know what? I want to have the kind of parnassa where I'm going to learn half a day and work half a day. I want the kind of job where I can work half a day and learn half a day. And he's absolutely convinced that he's going to make it work. And I say to him, how many people do you know that work half a day and learn half a day? And the bottom line is that although it's conceivable, but that kind of a plan is generally not rooted in reality. Because people have to work very, very hard, long hours, to be able, with good degrees and a profession, in order to put bread on the table. A frum Jew and his family require much, much more money than a non-Jewish or even secular Jewish family. If you just think what it costs to put five kids in yeshiva, and you're talking easily $20,000-$25,000, today health insurance starts with a family at $10,000. So we've already spent $35,000 and we haven't bought a piece of bread or a gallon of gas or an undershirt. Okay? And if we add to the mixture that in most developed Jewish communities, because of the demand and the growth of these communities, so housing becomes a premium. And today, you can't look at a house in Muncie for under $400,000. I'm not saying you have to live dafka in Muncie. But if you look around at other communities, nice communities where a frum family can live, one after another has significantly rising costs, and it's not an easy matter. If the Gemara says that parnasasa shalodim, the kosher parnasasa shalodim could kriyas yamsuf, the parnas of a person is as difficult as kriyas yamsuf, the splitting of the yamsuf. It means it's not just a little cinch, and I'll just, the person who says, I'm going to work half a day and learn half a day, is not hireable, because he has chalomis and dreams about how he's going to make a parnasa, and for 99.9% of people, that's just not realistic. Maybe after a person has worked hard and been successful and developed a team of people and runs a business and he can organize it such that he can allot several hours a day in the morning before he goes to business. But that's not how one starts off, and that's only if one has been blessed with a unique type of circumstance where you can do that. So, harbei osu v'loy olu biyadam. Many people have tried doing that and have not been that successful. Is it impossible? No. But here's the problem. Everyone who comes to me and says that he wants to learn in kollel, and then I tell him what I've said before, says, ah, but you said there were exceptions. I'm the exception. Everyone I talk about, you know, working half a day, learning half a day, and I say it doesn't work for most people, he says, but there are some exceptions, right? Every single one of the several hundred people that I've spoken to just about has said, I am that exception. And that's where one is not necessarily realistic. So, What do we have to do? Okay, put your nose to the grind. Okay, what do we really have to do in terms of readiness for shidduchim? Do I have to have my career so well worked out that that I'm just about to start working? Not necessarily. The bottom line is this: when you get married, there are going to be bills to be paid, and they're the husband's responsibility. In order to start dating, and again, I'm speaking primarily to the Baal Teshuva community, although the FFB community is experiencing significant difficulties in this area as well. But when you, if somebody is a real Talmud Chacham, and he's been through a strong yeshiva system, and his plan is to learn in Kollel, and he's going to have the emotional and material support, then it may be much more realistic for him and to learn in Kollel for several years. But even then, the question is going to be, once he's done, not that you'd ever done learning, but once he's done with his 3 years, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, or whatever it may be, of course, what is he going to do then? And that can often be, that is a social problem that we have today in the Torah community. But I'm addressing especially Baalei Teshuva, who probably won't have that kind of support that we're talking about. So how far along does one have to be? And I believe that the my best answer is this. One should be clear about what it is that I've chosen to do. I have to have a clear map of how I have or am or will be preparing myself for that reasonable career objective. I intend to do this. I need the training. I've already done this. I'm en route. I have a career path that is a reasonable, respectable way to make a parnasa. It would be much better if I've already completed that and I am marketable now. If I'm marketable, then it might be easier for me to spend a year learning first and then go into the workforce, because I don't have to worry about training, because it's much more difficult to train after you're married. Because usually training is in addition to some kind of an income, and it takes extra time, and that time you need to devote to family. I knew someone who decided, who had a career choice and who had to work and go to school, and was thinking of getting married at the same time. He went to a Gadol B'Yisrael who said, the demands of that kind of a program are just so difficult that I don't think you could get married and be married, spend any quality time with your wife, if you have both work and schooling while you get married. But he got married anyway. And by the time he finished school, then everything started falling apart. Everything started falling apart. In other words, his wife was able to sort of hold the fort and say, okay, I'll be here with you, I'll be here with you, I'll support you, I'll rally, and so on, because it was almost an impossible situation. Once the impossible situation finished, because he finished school, that's when everything sort of began to fall apart. So it's much, much more difficult to get the training after you're married than it is before you're married. Nevertheless, is it possible? There are many people in the secular world who were in medical school, in law school, in graduate schools, when they get married, and they take out loans, or there's family support. There's somehow or another, there are often ways that a person can get the training that you need to be able to get that degree or get that expertise while you're married. You don't necessarily have to have it all put together and finished by the time you start dating. But one certainly needs to have identified where I'm going. One certainly needs to have a clear path to get there. And optimally, a person should already have completed that path, or at least be on one's way, and it's charted out. This way, you're on a date, and the girl says to you, or the father of the girl says to you, and what do you intend to do, young man? So you have a clear answer. But forget about the father, the prospective father-in-law. You need it yourself in order for this to work. So the guy says, well, I'll figure it out afterwards in terms of what I'm going to do. That's asking for serious personal trouble. And therefore, when people come to me and they talk about readiness for dating, and I ask them half a dozen questions which are really these roughly half a dozen categories that I've outlined. And when it comes to career, often that's the nebulous area. And I say, figure it out first, and then accept the idea of starting to date. And hopefully, you take these tools, you assess yourself, and then you go, and this is crucial. As I said, you go to a mentor or to a Rebbe and say, here's how I rate myself. I really recommend doing this formally, with pen and paper in hand. Listen to these, perhaps these tapes again. I grade myself, I rate myself an 8 in this area, a 7 in this area. Number one, it'll help you to recognize what areas you might fall short in that need some work. But here's where objectivity is very important. There are many people who are overly critical of themselves. And when it comes to certain personal, let's say, areas of maturity, you might say, oh, I'm not ready to get married because, and you might be underestimating yourself. Well, maybe that needs to be addressed. Not to underestimate yourself so much. But the Rebbe might say, you know what? I think you're pretty fine. I know someone who came to me once and told me that he spent 7 years in a 12-step program of recovery for alcoholism. And I sat with him and I asked him exactly what was the worst he ever did, and I asked him for his experience. And it was absolutely evident to me that this individual was not an alcoholic. He didn't require a 12-step program. It's just that there was a touch of it, but not enough by any measures to consider him an alcoholic. But once you get into go to a meeting and a system that works, perpetuated for a period of 7 years, he walked out of my office a zombie, and he came back to me 3 or 4 days later. He said, I went over 7 years. He says, you're 100% right. So I just alcoholized somebody, de-alcoholized somebody, okay? I made him move backwards 12 steps, okay? I don't mean in any way to minimize, I'm not saying anything negative about a 12-step program, because they're wonderful, but I'm pointing out that sometimes people can be particularly hard on themselves, and you need to be objective, and your Rebbe might say, you know what? You're plenty ready to move ahead and start going.